Consolidated Industries, Mr. Bainton.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case presents essentially one issue, and that is namely whether those persons whose assets have been placed at risk by the entry of a Fernstrom-Shondell order partially vacating the automatic stay to permit state tort litigation to go forward on terms that impose no economic risk upon the debtor's estate have the right to compromise that litigation and thereby limit their risk. In this Court's opinion in Fernstrom, it talks about establishing a, quote, predicate for recovery, unquote.
Before you get into that, I wonder if you could address a little bit more your opponent's argument that the settlement agreement you're talking about is long since off the table anyway and just doesn't exist.
Well, Your Honor, that is not supported by the record. My opponent makes that argument by referring to events that occur after the trial concluded. The trustee says that after the trial concluded, we went forward and negotiated a settlement, referring to a docket entry in the docket of the bankruptcy court post-trial. If you look at that same docket entry, you will find an objection by a notice corporation which says, in substance, there is a better deal available, to wit, the very settlement we sought to enforce.
But does that mean, I'm looking at footnote 4 in your opponent's brief, which is on page 11, and I guess there are two issues here. One of them is whether they're calling it well-billed, you're calling it a notice, it doesn't really matter, whether there's an objection to the new settlement. But a separate question is whether even the mere existence of this new settlement means that the old one just isn't there anymore. People don't always leave settlements on the table forever.
That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, the record in the bankruptcy court reflects that the original settlement was still available as of the time we filed our objection to the new settlement. That's what the record in the bankruptcy court shows.
Well, what about today?
Your Honor, I don't know about today. I know what was true at the time the objection was filed. A trial of that objection hasn't been held. I can tell you that I know of no change in those facts. But in fairness and in complete candor, I did not call the Van Zandt's attorneys last night to see if what was true 6 months ago is true today. Mm-hmm. That said, this is, as our reply brief points out, this is not the first and presumably not the last time that the trustee with no economic stake in the resolution of tort litigation as to which a Fernstrom-Shondell order has been entered, has injected himself in the proceedings and proposed a settlement which cost the estate money, was not the best deal available, and defeated my client, who owns the insurance policies, who has the self-insured retention obligations, and whose policies are being eroded because obviously and these are occurrence-based policies. So the number of claims that will be filed against these policies won't be known for many years.
But maybe you could spell that out a little bit more, because, of course, the district court was also concerned about what actual interest you have in all of this. And you use that word eroded in your brief to talk about the policies. But I couldn't really follow what that meant, whether you're implying that there's some cap on overall recovery and you're going to exhausted, or whether if the Van Zandts get their little $20,000 payment, then maybe somebody, or you know, even some larger payment. Usually, insurance policies are occurrence-based, and there's a certain amount per occurrence. But anyway, if you could just spell out exactly what the financial impact of this is on your client.
Absolutely, Judge Wooden, and you've almost, I say most respectfully, just about answered your own question in asking it. All of these policies have a finite aggregate amount. There are layers, there are primary policies and excess policies, right? But each policy has an absolute amount, and after the insurance carrier pays that amount, it has no further obligation to pay anything more. These policies cover a notice, all of its operating subsidiaries, and consolidated to the extent that a dollar is spent to resolve a claim against any of the insureds. That is $1 less that is available to deal with future claims against other named insureds. That term, as I understand lingo in the insurance industry, is called erosion. You spend a dollar for insured one today, that's a dollar you don't have to protect insured two tomorrow. So that is one of our financial interests.
And you're saying these are with these long tail policies that you won't know perhaps for the next 50 years how many people are going to file claims under them?
Well, that's exactly correct, and we need to look no further than the asbestos litigation to have real-life occurrences in which very dusty insurance policies, which people thought had long escaped all financial obligation, now have substantial financial obligations. So, yes. And if I might, our second obligation, of course, is the self-insured retention payment, which is discussed comprehensively and accurately by the bankruptcy court and the two decisions upon which we rely. So that's a second financial interest we have here. And again,
so are you going to pay the full $20,000? I mean, I was confused.
No,
about
the carrier is paying.
Why are they paying that? If there's a $250,000 self-insured retention,
the carrier is paying the $20,000 as part of a negotiated settlement. In this case, there is a dispute now being litigated vigorously in the Central District of California as to whether the self-insured retention of $250,000 has been paid because there is one occurrence,
right,
or
right,
alternatively,
right,
whether there are multiple occurrences. So in the context of this litigation, in this case, in which the plaintiff was seeking to recover $8 million, the carrier had a chance to settle a case for $20,000 and said, will you agree to the erosion?
But right, then we get into this crazy Prometheus creditor business, which I gather seems to underlie the trustee's unwillingness to settle without a commitment by you not to say that this trustee no longer can pursue other litigation.
Your Honor, that contention by the trustee is, again, unsupported by the record. If you look at the record, which we cite in our... The judge talked about it, Your Honor, but if you look at the record, there was a pretrial order. Listed in the pretrial order was a copy of the Van Zandt State Court pleading together with two amendments to it. And in the pretrial order, there were objections. Our objections were, one, hearsay, because we believed it was an out-of-state declaration offered to prove the truth of the matters asserted therein, and relevancy, because under this court's decisions, for example, in In re Hall and Covey, when you talk about discounted value of contingent tort liabilities, if it's covered by insurance, the value is zero, and if something that has a value of zero is zero, why is it relevant to calculating these numbers? So that's what the record shows. The objections were, one, hearsay, two, relevancy, and that's what happened. Now, it seems to me obvious that the people whose money is at risk, ought to have the right to compromise litigation. The potential procedural problem here, of course, is that the compromise of any claim against a debtor's estate needs bankruptcy court approval. The laws of most states, including Alabama, in which the Van Zandt case was pending, prohibits direct action against the carrier until you obtain a judgment against its insured. That's what I thought this court meant when it wrote, quote, predicate for recovery. So to settle the case, which is the most important thing a litigant can do, and courts, including this one, favor settlement, you need to reach an agreement in the state court where the trustee, in this case a trustee, remains the nominal defendant under state law. And in order to settle that case without violating federal bankruptcy law, you need to get the representative of the debtor's estate to go to the bankruptcy court and say, may we please compromise this claim, and by the way, it's not going to cost the estate one penny. So that's the tension which we ask this court to resolve in this case. It seems to me that every time when a bankruptcy trustee in a Furnsham Shandell situation is presented with an opportunity to settle the case for no expense to the estate and thereby make the pro rata distribution for all other creditors, whatever it may be, higher by reason of the absence of this tort plaintiff, it's a no-brainer.
And why didn't he approve the settlement?
Well, Your Honor, that's speculation, but I'd be happy to speculate with you. This is a trustee who gets paid at 3% of all the money he distributes, right? And there is an issue as to what this estate solvent or insolvent, and whether it's solvent or insolvent determines upon how one values the loss contingencies represented by tort litigation. The value of tort litigation covered by insurance is very different from the value of tort litigation not covered by insurance. So to advance his interests in unrelated litigation, this trustee is trying to demonstrate that litigation which, in fact, is covered by insurance was not. That's what I think is going on, sir.
And why does he want to do that?
To prove a case against a notice with respect to fraudulent conveyance and fraudulent transfer. If Consolidated, sir, was never rendered in...
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, I thought you were suggesting he wanted to line his own pockets.
No, I'm suggesting, sir, that he is trying to prove that litigation which is covered by insurance is not covered by insurance.
Right.
By injecting
so
himself...
What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, it's deceitful. Second of all, Your Honor, it's inequitable. If you're going to enter a Fernstrom and Shondell order and place the assets of insurance companies in a notice at risk, they should have, I believe respectfully, the unqualified right to settle that litigation. Right? And if the litigation can be settled entirely by insurance proceeds, then let the chips fall where they may with respect to the proposition of solvency. But the truth is, and the truth ought to count for something, that this litigation clearly could have been settled for $20,000 payable entirely by insurance. That's consistent with our contentions with respect to solvency in another case and inconsistent with the trustees. But it is the truth, and Your Honor, in the context of this case, having had our assets placed at risk, we ought to be able to limit that risk without regard to its impact on other litigation by the trustee. That sort of litigation strategy should not, I respectfully submit, be condoned by this court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bank.
Thank you,
Mr. Levenstam.
May it please the court. Let me first bring you up to date on the status of the subsequent settlement. At 4:45 last night, I received by fax the final documents, including the dismissal of the Van Sant's case by the Alabama State Court. It is because of the lateness of the hour, it's my intention to file a motion with the court so that our opponent can respond and the effect of that can be addressed. That settlement was for $25,000, also covered completely by the insurance, and a $2,000 claim remains with the estate to avoid the Prometheus creditor issue that we're talking about. So
now, is that your response to the question Judge Posner just asked, Mr. Bainton? I mean, it does seem odd on its face that the trustee would have been so determined to block the other $20,000 settlement, which looked like a very small percentage of what the Van Sants had been originally asking for.
No, Your Honor, the answer is very clear. It's in the record, and the bankruptcy judge found it, and it is as follows. As we were proceeding to settle this case for $20,000, it came to our attention because we were on trial in the fraudulent conveyance matter that Enotis was planning to take the position that if the Van Sant case settled, we would no longer be able to rely on the Van Sants as the pre-existing or Prometheus creditor under Code Section 544B.
What's a Prometheus creditor? I missed that.
Well, the code requires that in order for the trustee to bring the fraudulent conveyance claim, there has to be a creditor who pre-exists the transfer that's allegedly fraudulent, who is also a creditor at the time of the bankruptcy petition filing.
Why is it called Prometheus?
I looked it up. It seems to have originated in Collier, like Prometheus Bound.
Exactly.
The trustee is chained to the rights of the creditor.
That was going to be my answer. But in point of fact, the law is very clear that the amount of the debt is not chained to the original Prometheus debtors.
So the trustee reserves this $2,000. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly. And the trustee, and it is also in the record because there was a trial, and the trust. And although Enotis listed six witnesses on the pretrial order for the trial, when the day finally came for the trial, they called one witness, the trustee. The whole testimony of the trial is 28 pages. It's shorter than Enotis's opening brief in this case. And what the trustee said was, I pulled the plug on this deal because I found out that they were going to start arguing that my what amounted to my $50 million claim is invalid because of the settlement of this Van Sant deal. And he even says we asked Enotis if they would forego making this argument that settlement of the Van Sant claim would undermine the fraudulent transfer claim, and they declined. And that's in the testimony at page 35, I believe. So that's why they pulled the plug. Now, the trustee testified to this. They put in no evidence to the contrary. There was no evidence from anybody at Enotis that they were not planning on making this argument. In 29 pages of opening brief, in 15 pages of reply brief, and in the first 10 minutes of this argument, they've never said that they're not pushing this point because if they undo Van Sant, they're going to raise that argument. Now,
going to raise what argument?
The argument that that we can no longer pursue the
$50 million. Well, actually, by now you have the January judgment from the district court of the $8.6 million and the other
right.
litigation. Then you've got the $43.3 from a July order. Is that all part of the same?
Yes, it's all fraudulent conveyance. It's
and
all the same adversary.
Are you still arguing 502D on this, or does this letter of credit from the Royal Bank of Scotland eliminate that?
No.
Element from the
no,
case.
We're still arguing 502D as well. 502D is very specific. It says that the any claim will be disallowed unless a person who's received fraudulent transfer has paid it back.
But why isn't the letter? I mean, the letter of credit means that there's no risk at all about the estates getting this payment, assuming this is all upheld on appeal. The bank now stands behind it, and the trustee simply fills in the form, and you get the money. I know you don't have it yet, but I mean,
right.
what's the risk that
well,
you won't get it?
The fact that we don't have it, I think, is part of what's important here, because I think what this is directed to is bringing funds into the estate in a timely fashion so that the estate can deal with the situation. I mean, but for this claim, this is very close to an assetless estate. And so it is our view that the express language of the statute specifically says has paid the amount or returned the property, not promised to return or secured the payment of. And we believe that that's an important part. So, yes, we are definitely still standing on our 502D.
But you would have to pay it back if they ultimately prevailed on appeal, right? So you're just envisioning this money shifting back and forth, potentially.
Yes. Well, okay. If they prevailed.
Right.
The underlying appeal, setting aside all of the standing and mootness complexity, is really basically a very simple appeal. He came to court asking for a mandatory injunction to compel the trustee to execute a settlement that the trustee didn't want to execute. And the trustee, there was a trial. The trustee explained why. The judge credited that, and this is a judge who had at that time been sitting on these proceedings and proceeding over them for 4 years. So he knew the situation very well. He knew the players very well. He was in the middle of a lengthy trial. And so I think really Enotis has basically three strikes against it. You know, strike one is that the trustee has business judgment rule deference in terms of decisions that he makes. I think strike two is the broad discretion, the equitable discretion that the bankruptcy court has in terms of giving mandatory injunctive relief and in terms of addressing settlements. And then strike three is that there is just no basis in the bankruptcy code anywhere for an injunction against a trustee like this. And if you look at the Fernstrom and Shondell decisions on which they rely, they're stay-lifting cases. But in no way, shape, or form do they authorize an injunction against the trustee, or for that matter, do they somehow deprive a trustee of his right to do what he thinks is best for the trust estate. And when my opponent argues that we have no economic interest in this situation, that's 100% incorrect. The trustee says, as I view this, I've got increased litigation expenses because I'm going to have to defend the fact that the Van Sant claim still qualifies as a Prometheus claim. And there's some small risk, however small it is, and it is very small, that he could prevail. Now, to do a little bit of economic analysis here, you've got about $50 million roughly, and we upped our cash input by $5,000. So I think that comes to roughly a 1 in 10,000 chance.
The $50 million represents what?
The fraudulent conveyance judgments that we got, the 8.6 from the district court in summary judgment in January, and then the $43 million.
This is on the base of the Van Zandt, this retained
Van Zandt Prometheus creditor.
And the judgment is against whom?
Enotis.
But it
the fraudulent transfers.
And this is the parent of the bankrupt, is that it?
Well, it's Enotis. The former parent of the bankrupt. There were some intervening sales, yes. So, for all those reasons, unless there are any further questions, Your Honors, we would ask for affirmance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Levenstam. Mr. Bainton, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
I think I'll take less. I agree with Mr. Levenstam. It is a simple case. I think you have to answer one question. Is it equitable to issue one of these orders, placing other people's money at risk, and then prohibiting them from settling state court tort litigation? I agree that if...
An assumption that you're making here is that all settlements are automatically in the interest of the bankruptcy estate. And that, because actually what you're saying is once the first order has been issued with the partial lift of the automatic stay so that the nominal case can go on in the state court action, then the only thing left for the bankruptcy court to do is rubber stamp any settlement. And here, although, of course, the litigation moved forward to the point that it produced that initial settlement, then when you took it back to the bankruptcy court, the trustee did have an objection to make. And Mr. Levenstam's point, I think, is that it's at that point that you really are at issue. It's not that anybody's objecting to the fact that the state court litigation happened, but does the bankruptcy court have no role but to rubber stamp?
Yes, because of the original order, Judge Wood. When the original order was entered, they said go forward in state court where the trustee must remain a nominal defendant under state law and determine the liability, the obligations of a notice and the insurance carrier to the Van Zandts.
But I don't see that in Fernstrom and Shondell. I don't see the next step being taken. They're about the stay to begin with and why it is that you can allow this litigation consistently with 362, whereas you're saying, and in addition, anything they come up with must be approved by the court.
It leaves the bankruptcy court with an order that says whatever happens in state court can have no impact whatsoever on the bankruptcy estate. It leaves the bankruptcy court, the debtor or trustee remains a nominal defendant because state law requires it. The other people's money is at risk. They reach a compromise that the exercise of their judgment is appropriate. The bankruptcy code, because the bankruptcy trustee remains a nominal defendant, requires that the people who's reached this compromise must obtain bankruptcy court approval. By what theory is it equitable to permit?
But isn't it in the Van? I find this case hard to follow, but isn't it in the Van Zandt's interest to have this claim against a notice?
Correct, Judge Posner. It would have been the Van Zandt's interest to try the case and win $8 million, but they apparently didn't like their prospects at trial. It's always better to have more money than lesser. But the point is, there was a point in time at which they were prepared to compromise this case for a smaller sum of money. That money is coming out of insurance policies owned by my client. That's the risk. We had curtailed that risk, and the trustee, we submit, had no seat at that table to second judge our decision to settle litigation in which he had no economic stake.
But you agreed when you were arguing the first time that he does have a potential benefit from having a block. No, I understand your point. The Van Zandts apparently didn't care that much about having this little tail, this little fraudulent conveyance claim. But But the trustee, you agreed, had a financial stake in financial benefit to anticipate by refusing to settle. So why can't he do that?
Judge Posner, respectfully, I believe you misquoted me. I said that was his motive, not his stake. Trials are about the truth.
Well,
the truth is...
Wait a second. So you're saying he thought he could have a benefit from keeping the fraudulent conveyance action alive, but he didn't. He made a mistake. He can't benefit from what he's doing.
That is correct, sir, because the truth is that the Van Zants were prepared to settle this case on the date of the settlement agreement for the terms stated therein. There was a trial. Those are facts. Those facts are not in
what
dispute.
Are facts? I don't understand.
The
you.
Facts,
lost
sir,
me
the,
completely.
The facts, Judge Posner, are that these state court tort plaintiffs were prepared to settle.
No, I understand that, but the question is, why would anybody have to agree to a settlement if he thought he could do better not settling? So if the trustee thinks he can do better by keeping this claim alive, even though the Van Zants have no interest in it, have no particular desire, why can't he do that?
Because, sir, it's inequitable to give him the upside.
He has a benefit, doesn't he?
He perceives he has a benefit.
Well, then why can't a party to a settlement, unless you control him in some way, I don't understand why he can't just decide he's better off not settling.
Because we control the risk, sir. That's the whole argument.
If you were his insurance carrier or something and actually control the bankruptcy, yes, but you don't control the trustee. All you can do is throw yourself on the mercy of the trustee in the bankruptcy court. You had that shot, and they decided it was in the benefit of the debtor's estate to push on with this.
So therefore, they could force us to trial, and we could have a judgment in state court for the $8 million the Van Zants sought, even though we could have settled it for $20,000. We've got to pay the $8 million. The trustee never had any economic interest, and that's an equitable result.
You could have settled it. You could have. You're not the other side of the Van Zant case. The trustee is.
The trustee is, in the words of Van...
The trustee is not your agent, right?
He is the nominal defendant. That's the word that the Fernstrom decision uses. He is the nominal defendant. The people whose money is being spent is my clients and insurance policies that we own and are being eroded. Right? He has no economic interest. He is the nominal defendant only.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.